The Turks adopted violent repressive measures and embarked upon massacres of Bulgarians on an enormous scale. Thereupon Russia intervened in 1877, and after a year of costly warfare obliged the Turks to sign the Treaty of San Stefano, which was, on the whole, a sensible treaty, breaking up the artificial Turkish Empire and to a large extent establishing the natural map. But it had become the tradition of British policy to thwart the designs of Russia. Heaven knows why. Whenever Russia appeared to have a design, the British Foreign Office, under the premiership of Lord Beaconsfield, intervened with a threat of war if a considerable restoration of the Turks' facilities for exaction, persecution, and massacre wasn't made. For a time, war seemed very probable. The British music halls, those lamps to British foreign policy, were lit with patriotic fire, and the London errand boy on his rounds was inspired to chant, with the simple dignity of a great people conscious of its high destinies, a song declaring that we don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we got the ships, we got the men, we got the money too. And so on to a climax, the Russians shall not have Constantinople. In consequence of this British opposition, a conference was assembled in 1878 at Berlin to revise the Treaty of San Stefano, chiefly in the interests of the Turkish and Austrian monarchies. The British acquired the island of Cyprus, to which they had no sort of right whatever, and which has never been of the slightest use to them, and Lord Beaconsfield returned triumphantly from the Berlin conference to the extreme exasperation of Mr. Gladstone, with what the British were given to understand at the time was peace with honour. This Treaty of Berlin was the second main factor, the Peace of Frankfurt being the first, in bringing about the Great War of 1914-18. These 30 years after 1848 are years of very great interest to the student of international political methods. Released from their terror of a worldwide insurrection of the common people, the governments of Europe were doing their best to resume the game of great powers that had been so rudely interrupted by the American and French revolutions. But it looked much more like the old game than it was in reality. The mechanical revolution was making war a far more complete disturbance of the general life than it had ever been before, and the proceedings of the diplomatists were ruled, in spite of their efforts to disregard the fact, by imperatives that Charles V and Louis XIV had never known. Irritation with misgovernment was capable of far better organization and far more effective expression than it had ever been before. Statesmen dressed this up as the work of the spirit of nationalism, but there were times and occasions when that costume wore very thin. The grand monarchs of the 17th and 18th centuries had seemed to be free to do this or that, to make war or to keep the peace, to conquer this province or cede that as they willed. But such a ruler as Napoleon III went from one proceeding to another with something of the effect of a man who feels his way among things unseen. None of these European governments in the 19th century was in fact a free agent. We look today at the maps of Europe since 1814. We compare them with the natural map, and we see that the game the great powers played was indeed a game of foregone conclusions. Whatever arrangements they made that were in accordance with the natural political map of the world and the trend towards educational democracy held, and whatever arrangements they made contrary to these things collapsed. We are forced, therefore, to the conclusion that all the diplomatic fussing, posturing, and scheming, all the intrigue and bloodshed of these years, all the monstrous turmoil and waste of kings and armies, all the wonderful attitudes, deeds, and schemes of the Clavaurs, Bismarcks, Disraelis, Bonapartes, and the like great men, might very well have been avoided altogether, had Europe but had the sense to instruct a small body of ordinarily honest ethnologists, geographers and sociologists, to draw out its proper boundaries and prescribe suitable forms of government in a reasonable manner. The romantic phase in history had come to an end. A new age was beginning, with new and greater imperatives, and these 19th-century statesmen were but pretending to control events. 9th. We've suggested that in the political history of Europe between 1848 and 1878, the mechanical revolution wasn't yet producing any very revolutionary changes. The post-revolutionary great powers were still going on within boundaries of practically the same size and with much the same formalities as they had done in pre-revolutionary times. But where the increased speed and certainty of transport and telegraphic communications were already producing very considerable changes of condition and method, was in the overseas enterprises of Britain and the other European powers, and in the reaction of Asia and Africa to Europe. The end of the 18th century was a period of disrupting empires and disillusioned expansionists. The long and tedious journey between Britain and Spain and their colonies in America prevented any really free coming and going between the homeland and the daughter lands, and so the colonies separated into new and distinct communities with distinctive ideas and interests and even modes of speech. As they grew, they strained more and more at the feeble and uncertain link of shipping that joined them. Weak trading posts in the wilderness, like those of France in Canada, or trading establishments in great alien communities, like those of Britain in India, might well cling for bare existence to the nation which gave them support and a reason for their existence. That much and no more seemed to many thinkers in the early part of the 19th century to be the limit set to overseas rule. In 1820, the sketchy great European empires outside of Europe that had figured so bravely in the maps of the middle 18th century had shrunken to very small dimensions. Only the Russian sprawled as large as ever across Asia. It sprawled much larger in the imaginations of many Europeans than in reality, because of their habit of studying the geography of the world upon Mercator's projection, which enormously exaggerated the size of Siberia. The British Empire in 1815 consisted of the thinly populated coastal river and lake regions of Canada, and a great hinterland of wilderness in which the only settlements as yet were the fur-trading stations of the Hudson Bay Company, about a third of the Indian Peninsula under the rule of the East India Company, the coast districts of the Cape of Good Hope inhabited by blacks and rebellious-spirited Dutch settlers, a few trading stations on the coast of West Africa, the Rock of Gibraltar, the island of Malta, Jamaica, a few minor slave labor possessions in the West Indies, British Guiana in South America, and on the other side of the world, two dumps for convicts at Botany Bay in Australia and in Tasmania. Spain retained Cuba and a few settlements in the Philippine Islands. Portugal had in Africa some vestiges of her ancient claims. Holland had various islands and possessions in the East Indies and Dutch Guiana, and Denmark an island or so in the West Indies. France had one or two West Indian islands and French Guiana. This seemed to be as much as the European powers needed, or were likely to acquire of the rest of the world. Only the East India Company showed any spirit of expansion. In India, as we've already told, a peculiar empire was being built up not by the British peoples nor by the British government, but by this company of private adventurers with their monopoly and royal charter. The company had been forced to become a military and political power during the years of Indian division and insecurity that followed the breakup of India after the death of Aurangzeb in 1707. It had learned to trade in states and peoples during the 18th century. Clive founded, Warren Hastings organized, this strange new sort of empire.